Friday at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial.
And 3CR Digital, streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
So together, let's think again about important matters affecting us, like economics,
politics,
education,
health,
climate,
and what we can do about it all. Welcome to our 320th Think Again program, produced by Borderlands Cooperative, an organization working for social change for meanwhile almost 28 years. Actually, next month it will be 28 years. We're broadcasting from the 3CR studio on the not-ceded land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Jacques Boulet, and Jennifer has a day off today, so I'm talking today with Clinton Fernandez, a name probably familiar to our listeners, as we have referred several times to his earlier book about Australia being a sub-imperial power, serving the imperial aspirations of the US. So welcome to the program, Clinton.
Hello, Jacques. Good to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Clinton Fernandez is a professor of international and political studies at the University of New South Wales and a longtime friend of Borderlands. Clinton, your new book titled Turbulence, Australian Foreign Policy in the Trump Era, which has just been published by Melbourne University Press, and as Professor Klaus Dodds also suggests, is in many ways a further explication of your previous work, highlighting the role Australia plays as a sub-imperial power to the US's desire for global hegemony. So Turbulence puts it in the context of the second Trump coming and the present Australian Albanese government. So to get us started, could you just very succinctly, if that is possible, with a massive book like what you've written, could you share with us, with our listeners, the main thesis underlying the two books, actually?
Sure, I'll try. Basically, look, the book itself is not that long. It's only about 30,000 words, and it's meant to be read in a single weekend. But I'll try in a single sentence about that. A sub-imperial power is both sub-imperial, subordinate, and powerful. What I mean is Australia is not a client state. Rather, we subordinate important aspects of our sovereignty, our defense policy, and our foreign policy in service of the imperial system while exerting significant power in our own area of influence. Now, what I mean by this is that the essence of an empire or an imperial system is really the control of sovereignty, not necessarily territory. When we think of an empire, we think of France and Indochina or Britain and India or somewhere else with direct physical rule. But controlling a country's or a society's sovereignty doesn't require direct rule. It can be established by political collaboration between both countries' elites, by economic control, by cultural control, by intelligence operations, and, of course, by the threat of force or the use of force. And so the United States doesn't colonize in the traditional sense, but it sits at the apex of a hierarchically structured imperial system where it can control the political sovereignty of many countries without annexing them. And Australia is not a vassal state or an exploited neo-colony. We are a sub-imperial power. We are the junior partner of the empire, as we were the junior partner of the British Empire. And so, you know, we have a capable technological, military, sophisticated intelligence agencies and a standard of living that attracts immigrants to our country. We are not somehow victims. Rather, we are beneficiaries of the imperial system. That's the broad thesis, I'd say.
Thank you. That's quite explanatory in a couple of paragraphs. Thank you for that. And in previous Think Again programs, we have discussed the main three areas of U.S. global involvement, which you now elaborate in the Turbulence book. You very helpfully organized the global strategy employed by the U.S. and aided and abetted by Australia's foreign policy in three what you call front lines. And those three front lines are Europe, the Middle East, and China. And they explicate the political, military, economic overlapping elements that inform that strategy you just have very briefly explained. It would help our listeners, I think, to briefly hear your explanation as to how Australia is involved in those three front lines.
Sure. Well, the first front line is Europe, and we are less involved there than in the other two. But the basic idea in frontline Europe is that Trump is not abandoning Europe. He's not leaving Europe, unlike whatever people are saying in the press. He is subordinating Europe. He is subordinating the advanced industrial powers of Europe, which is in the west and the northwest of Europe. And he's trying to promote the Eastern Europeans, who are the frontline states in his confrontation. The idea, of course, is to halt the economic integration of the Eurasian continent. Whereby you have German technology, French technology, using Russian energy, and then the Chinese market. All of that would have created a single Eurasian continental front, and Trump wants to block that. And we are not that involved in that. The second front line is the Middle East. And what Trump is trying to do there is control oil. The United States is not interested in accessing oil. It wants to control oil. That means it wants to control the terms by which other countries get their oil. It wants to have a say. It wants veto power. For that, it needs a cop on the block, and that cop on the block is Israel. It wants to make sure that Israel dominates the region militarily, but backed up by Arab monarchical money, the oil wealth, petrodollars of the Gulf, can back up Israel. So provide Arab labor. There are educated people up there. They've got technologically sophisticated, lots of engineers. Arab labor, Gulf money, and Israeli muscle. So, and we are absolutely involved in assisting the United States there. And the third front line, of course, is Taiwan or China, which is the same sort of region. And what we want to do there is preserve the ability to threaten China and cut off its oil and gas and its fuel supplies by blockading it, should we choose to do so. I mean, that's the United States policy. And whatever we're doing in terms of freedom of navigation exercises, which is a big euphemism, is designed to demonstrate our relevance to dominating China should the United States choose to do it.
And particularly because of the fact that you are also have been in the army, in the Australian army, and know quite a bit how that works, and therefore also have lots of information about armaments and weapons and all of that, and how they work and why they are in places they need to be. That is actually what really struck me about your Turbulence book, that that starts to then make much more physical sense to understand why it is that certain things are happening in our neighborhood and all of that.
The whole point is that the real goals of our defense policy are not the same as our declared goals.
Yeah.
The declared goal is defense and deterrence. The real goal is domination of other countries. And I believe that the reason the government doesn't say the real goal is it fears that the Australian public would never support it.
Of course. And therefore they come up with that sing song about a right to self-defense and all of that, as they do for Israel. It's quite amazing. So it's really interesting how, what for simplicity's sake I call the rest of the West, allows itself to be commandeered by the Anglosphere nations into what you refer to as a sub-imperial role, however differently they are. The rest of the West countries, they're obviously together playing together playing into this game dominated by the US or directed by the US. Have you got any further thoughts about this?
The reason Europe goes along with it is that they basically share the United States' support for the West to dominate the rest of the world. And within that, they are quite happy, or they have no alternative, to being subordinate to the United States in that overarching goal. I mean, both countries, both Europe's elites, that's the German business community, the German banking community, the French industrial system, they all support control over the global South. It's just that the United States is the lead country that can actually do it. And so for them, they have to, be in the slipstream of American power if they are to achieve their own goals. The problem for them now is that, unlike the Soviet Union, China is economically integrated with Western Europe. And so what they have to do is break that connection, which means they have to take, the United States has to take actions that reduce the economic strength of Europe, because that's what makes it more pliable in its own attempt to confront China.
And in a way, you talked about the Southern Hemisphere, so it fits therefore also in that, let me call it, neo-colonial and neo-imperial kind of a world system.
Yeah, they call it that, but I mean, it's still, empire is just empire, right? Mm. I mean, it doesn't have to be, it can call it neo-empire, but I guess that's, it makes it more confusing to people. Well, the truth is that empire has always been about the control of another society's sovereignty. It doesn't have to involve direct physical occupation and control. Mm. You know, that idea of empire goes back to basically the start of empires. I mean, Julius Caesar wrote about it, you know, and he knew something about empires. That as long as another tribe on the outside the borders of the empire wouldn't enter into military arrangements or any other kinds of arrangements that conflicted with the empire's goals, as far as Caesar was concerned, they were still in the empire then. They didn't have to be physically possessed by Rome in order to be part of the Roman Empire.
And how does that, for example, translates into Australian policy or politics?
Yeah, well, exactly. See, for example, the lot of talk is going on about the energy transition and the green transition and so on. And what's important are these so-called critical minerals, these rare earths, the minerals that are absolutely vital for a high-tech transition. Well, in 2013, Geoscience Australia did a study called Critical Commodities for a High-Tech World. Anybody can Google that phrase, Critical Commodities for a High-Tech World. And they found that Australia was, in fact, very rich in the critical commodities needed to get into batteries, into, you know, advanced materials, manufacturing, all of those raw materials. We could, if we wanted to, set up a national critical minerals company. And that way we could ensure that the resources of this country principally benefit the economic development of our own country. Well, we would never do that, because the point is to demonstrate our relevance. And so we prefer to carve up bits of the continent and ship it north so that the United States and the Europeans can manufacture the more advanced materials, and so can China, and we then buy the proceeds. So that's how we subordinate our sovereignty in the interests of the larger imperial system. The talk about gas prices and all that, you know, misses one key point, namely that if we had a national gas company like Qatar does, we could hold on to our own resources and then improve and benefit our own people as well as share, you know, with the people of our region. That's not what's going on. Rather, we've got a system whereby we ensure that our gas is used to benefit, say, Japan, because the United States' key ally in Northwestern Pacific is Japan. So Japan gets the gas on terms that are cheaper for its own customers than Australian customers get gas. And then Japan then exports that gas. So in other words, we are selling gas to Japan at a discount, and it then exports its own gas, to other countries. So all of that is designed to demonstrate our relevance, our economic relevance and our military relevance, rather than support for Australian sovereignty.
But it particularly also supports those 1%ers who gain because of the existence of the thing called capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, it's the corporations that are on the stock exchange, you know, have about, the top 20 companies have about 50%, say 47% of the value of the entire stock exchange.
Yeah.
And out of that, the mining and gas, you know, the energy companies, the mining companies, are quite big on that. But those are largely foreign-owned. You know, U.S. portfolio investors own more of the Australian Stock Exchange's top companies than Australian investors do. And so the managers of those businesses have a vested interest in ensuring the reliability of the imperial supply system rather than anything that benefits Australia specifically.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just to let listeners catch their breath and myself catch my breath a bit, let's have a bit of a music break and listen to Archie Roach, Cannot Buy My Soul, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
For 200 years we've been beaten down, too long on the door. My dignity I'm losing here, mentally I'm on. There's a system here that nails us, and we're left out in the cold. Oh, they took our life and liberty friends, but they could not buy our soul. Joe Hill died, Che Guevara fought, Pamela Roy lay down dead. If a person speaks out critically here, they could get loaded down with lead. How long can the majority wait for their story to unfold? Oh, they took their life and liberty friends, but they could not buy their soul. But the clever man spoke precisely, humanity said was done. The creed for greed could not proceed if our struggles to be won. For humanity is more important here than a constant quest for gold. Ah, you may take life and liberty friends, but you cannot buy our soul. One morning, rode a donkey up through that gate. He could see quite clearly he was going to meet his fate.
You're listening to Think Again on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial, and streaming live at 3cr.org.au. Today I'm having a conversation with Clinton Fernandez about his new book, Turbulence, which is about Australia's role in the further strengthening and maintenance of US global imperial power. Clinton, looking back over, in my case, 60 or so years of living, I have to say that I've never experienced or seen so much global control resting with what we still call news, media and agencies. The fakeization of news and its suppression into silence. What role do they play, that means media, and now including also the social media, in what you call the turbulence or the turbulent times we inhabit? I know it's a little bit out of what we usually talk about when we talk about international politics, but I think it's really important.
Oh, it's very important, and I'm glad you brought it up. In fact, I'd like to hear your views on it, given your greater experience on this. So, about 40 years ago, there was a movement at the United Nations and in other regional fora about who controls information, what kind of news is reported about, say, developing countries, and which countries are more responsible for producing the news, and whose version of the news gets reported. And that used to be called... that project to democratize that was called the New World Information and Communication Order. You may remember that from the 1970s. It was said then at the time that the developing world needed its own news agencies in order to have its people and its own concerns reported fairly, rather than simply a place of violence or some ethnic music or ethnic food and some new recipes. Rather, that they should see them as actual people with their own concerns and their own interests. And I think that that demand for a new world information and communication order remains as relevant as always. And the absence of that is what we're seeing with this explosion of news, because all that's happened really is the fact this technology drives distribution. You know, in the past, you'd go to a record store to buy a record. Now you get it on your phone. And so now you've got these types of media which originate largely from the United States, and they put together a version of the world that's designed sometimes to agitate, to increase the level of adrenaline and tension, certainly not to report the facts. But I do say that the business press are, in fact, the most accurate press that you can find nowadays in the mainstream. Mm. You know, the business sections of even the normal news are still fine, because they are written for people who actually invest in the country and largely own the country. And so for them, they have to provide reliable news that's less ideological. So I think that's where it is. But I'd be very keen to hear your views on this, because you've studied this subject much longer than I have.
Well, I would agree with you there, because the only Age bit I still buy is the Saturday Age, which has a business section inside, which is probably mostly forgotten by most normal people. But I am really a very adamant reader of it, because there's what happens is the way in which many of those business writers present themselves or make their comments, it's almost like, without any awareness of the context, the political economy context within which they speak. You know, the almost unashamed kind of an admission that business is all about growth, making money, whatever it takes.
Actually, no, Jacques. I think that the narrative is that it's about jobs, because the word making money and profits is never mentioned.
Yeah, but the thing is, you see, those who need the jobs and those who think jobs, they never go to the business section in the Saturday Age. You know what I mean? They read the sensationalist stuff in the front section with big, certainly in the Herald Sun or any of those.
Yeah.
You know, with big titles, the title makers in any of those newspapers are just fake artists, because they create a text or a title out of something which has often no relationship to the content of the article they are titling.
Yep. Well, I mean, one thing that should happen, of course, you know, apart from the fact we ought to have more community radio stations, you know, why should the Earth's electromagnetic spectrum is a result of geological evolution, and it doesn't have to belong to a few hundred super-rich families in the media. Right? But that said, community radio could do everybody a great service by simply talking about what's in the business press, business pages of, say, the newspapers you mentioned, rather than what's on the front page of the press, you know, and that would be a real service to the community if community radio were to focus more on that as a regular section, because that tells the public what the business community is actually up to.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do, actually, with Think Again, you know, and the title of our program is Think Again, both in the sense of start thinking again, but also think it over again, kind of. And so, and 3CR is, as you probably know anyway, is a studio where that is celebrated and highlighted. So, I agree with you. I, for example, personally look always at things like Jacobin and Intersect and those alternative news media which come from the United States and from Europe, and that's where lots of our programs are fed by in terms of real news.
Yes, but also the business press of the age, as you mentioned. You know, what the Saturday Age, for example, reports, but in the business section, not in the normal what they call the news section.
That's right.
That's the real news.
I agree. I totally agree. Yeah. Finally, because we slowly are running out of time, unfortunately, the nature of present-day U.S. and its accomplices' hegemony as a lethal combination of weapons, capital, politics, and algorithms. Given what you have detailed and shared in your books, what are our chances of throwing it into a different direction?
It requires organization. Along the lines of things we just said just a few minutes ago, of course. But I think that the prospects are not too bad if one understands that the public actually has a latent support for the kinds of things that you've been talking about. Mm. It's just that public opinion reflects the choices that the public perceives. And therefore, public opinion is it's not set in stone. The fact that the public generally supports or doesn't challenge or acquiesces in the dominant system, it doesn't mean that they enthusiastically support it. It's just that they aren't aware of some viable alternatives. And, you know, it's the task of organizers to show that the world could be arranged under different lines rather than the paths chosen for us by the masters of mankind.
Mm. Yeah, and you, as well as we, have been for quite a while now involved in things like that. But it sometimes looks as if it is, well, the David and Goliath kind of a meme has been so wrongly exploited, but
But I mean, David versus Goliath is a good example. I mean, to take the case of Timor-Leste, East Timor, right to our north, the richest country in the region, namely us, took the oil and gas of the poorest country in the region, namely Timor-Leste. Now, they had very little ability to change policy, but policy was changed. And how was that done? Mm. By ordinary people in the Timor Solidarity Network talking about and raising awareness among Australians about what the government was actually doing. Mm. And as a result, it wasn't anywhere near a perfect outcome, but Timor did become independent and does have control over some of its oil and gas. Mm. And in a way that would never have happened if any other country had tried to go up against Australia. Mm. And that's because of the existence of solidarity groups in Australia that could challenge Australian government policy. Mm. So that's a path forward, I think. Yeah. Solidarity with those people and just bringing to Australians' knowledge and attention news about what the government is actually doing, because if the public actually knows what the government is doing, they would never support it.
Mm, that's correct. And in some ways, I figure the peace movement in Australia seems to be slowly wakening up again after a bit of a hiatus of 20 or so years, particularly also about the nuclear armaments and all of that, as you also refer to in your book. So I can just only conclude to our listeners, please go and buy Clinton's book. It is absolutely important because he really combines information about weapons, about why weapons are in the places they are, why Australia makes decisions about weapons and all those kinds of things. So thank you, Clinton, for helping us with this. And
thanks for the opportunity, Jacques.
And I really look forward to seeing you again around Borderlands and about all the kinds of things we do.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
A little bit about community things which are happening at Borderlands. Our community garden at Borderlands, we have an end-of-year garden Christmas party from 7 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday, the 17th of December. Please bring drinks and a plate to share, and we can also talk about all the kinds of things Clinton and I have just been chatting about. But also bring your loved ones and dress fancy. The new community journal last issue was on peace, and please have a look at it, because there is quite some exciting opportunities to get involved. In our programs. Thank you for listening to Think Again at 3CR Community Radio. If you want to send us any comments about today's program, you can email borders@borderlands.org.au. And remember, our past programs are available by podcast on a variety of platforms and via the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. So to finish our program, and bring us into Jailbreak, a program often by our sisters and brothers in jail. Please enjoy Milky Manna by King Stingray.
Go. and by the fire. Man, I got no reason to rise. I never lose touch. What kind of man do you think I am?
Hey, you
ain't.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.